Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear. Vanity Fair.
Kara, you could have covered anything, any part of this weird, wonderful world. Why did you land on tech? Why Silicon Valley?
Oh, Brian, I don't know. I regret it now, these many 30 years hence. No, I just loved it the minute I started covering it. It was so interesting to me. It was love at first sight.
That's the one, the only Kara Swisher, the pioneering tech reporter behind brands like All Things D and Recode. She now hosts the On with Kara Swisher podcast. She co-hosts Pivot, and she's the author of a brand new memoir called Burn Book, which comes out next week. And I'm Brian Stelter. Let me welcome you to Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. This week, we're going inside what Swisher calls a tech love story. That's the subtitle of Burn Book. Swisher has been covering tech since the early days of Netscape. She's made relationships. She's lost relationships with the tech founders and CEOs that have changed our world. And Kara, you say you've gradually transformed from a journalist to more of an advocate.
Kind of.
You chronicle that in the book. What's the difference in your mind and why has that happened?
It's that I have a point of view. Like, I have done enough reporting to have a point of view and everything. And I think I had started that journey when I left the Wall Street Journal, and it was in the Wall Street Journal to start All Things D, because that was the charge of it, is we didn't just scoop, which we did. We'd get the scoops and get the news, but we also told you what it meant. And at some point when Steve Jobs, you know, would say, "We're not working on a phone," I was like, "I don't believe you." Like, which is what I would say to him if I was in his office, right? I don't believe you. So why not say it publicly? And I think you're doing it because of this, this, and this. And that's, is that a point of view? Is that, or I think what you're doing at Facebook is dangerous. And here's why. And I'm going to argue with you about it. And so is that advocacy or is it just truth?
Well, here are a couple of lines in Burn Book that show your analysis, your point of view about this industry. You wrote, "It is ever more urgent that we take back control." Can you explain what that means, control? Control from who, and how do we do it? How do we take back control?
Well, we never have taken control. So we've given it over to the tech people since the very beginning. They've had all the leverage, and the people who paid for it have had none, right? If you want to come up with one theme of this book, do you want to give unaccountable power over the most important aspects of our society going forward and currently to the richest and most unaccountable people on the planet? I'm not as comfortable with it. And by the way, there are, a lot of them are the same. They're all the same people. And is that the way we want to conduct our democracy? I'm not so interested in that.
You also say, quote, "Where tech goes depends on who makes the decisions."
Right.
And you know the people that have been making the decisions. It seems like the more you interviewed them, the more skeptical, maybe the less trusting, the more concerned.
They don't know what they're talking about. Like, why am I listening to venture capitalists on Ukraine? I don't really want to. I want them to shut up. They can say things.
What a shot at the All In podcast there.
Well, no, just any of them. They're all, there's not just them. You see them, everyone. Like, oh, let me tell you about this. Let me tell you. But that's like a typical, that they're much more typical. But the smart ones don't, because they, you know, they don't know what
the
they're talking about.
The smart ones don't, right?
You don't hear Tim Cook going on about Ukraine. He wouldn't. Why would he? He's an adult. He knows that he doesn't know what he's talking about. I bet he probably does more than they do, by the way, FYI. He's done business there. He's done business in Russia. I would trust his point of view a whole lot more than a lot of people's, but he ain't going to mouth off because he's an adult person who has control over his emotions and doesn't need a constant licking up and down by anonymous fanboys on Twitter, whatever. In any case.
Shout out Elon Musk. And we're talking about, the immature. Who are the mature ones other than Tim Cook?
Man.
Other than Tim Cook, who are the adults in the room? Sam Altman at OpenAI. He's interviewing you on your book tour.
I like him. I think he's thoughtful. Like, look, I'll take a thoughtful adult approach any day of the week at this point. Like, and here we have Sam who's saying, okay, there are dangers. Let's discuss. And he got it. He got a little comeuppance, but he recovered pretty nicely. You know, you have him trying at least think big thoughts. At the same time, he's going to do what's in his interests. He's an aggressive entrepreneur, obviously. I mean, everyone's like, can you believe it? I'm like, I can believe that he's going to do what's in his interests. But I'm okay with that as long as we all understand the stakes of the game. And then you have, you know, Elon, who's like making boob jokes, and he's 52 years old almost continually and talking about women's uteruses, of which he's had a lot of children, but he still doesn't know about women's uteruses.
He does not know.
Right. I feel like, why are we giving these people the ability to make decisions that should be done by a group of people? You know, I mean, in that regard, and why do they get to make decisions that affect us all? They don't feel like they have any responsibility for the things they say and the impact it has in the real world. And that's always been that became a pressing issue for me as 2016 dawned, when you could see the implications of it.
Right. Is that the closest thing to a red line, a kind of before and after moment in your career? I mean, 2016 being, of course, the election, Donald Trump's election. Mm-hmm. And then there's that moment you write about in the book where the CEOs of the big tech firms, Jeff Bezos, Tim Cook, they go and meet the newly elected president.
Larry Page, Alphabet and Google, probably the youngest company here.
The youngest person.
Yeah, I'm really glad to be here.
Sheryl Sandberg, Facebook. Excited to talk about jobs.
Mike Pence, governor of Indiana for a few more days, and vice president of the United States.
Well, I just want to thank everybody. This is a truly amazing group of people. I won't tell you the hundreds of calls we've had asking to come to this meeting.
Is that the red line moment? Yeah, but so why did that meeting...
It was one of them. I started to see it coming because Maria Ressa, who won the Nobel Prize for her work in the Philippines and stuff, she warned me, like you could see it happening there. And there was some great reporting by a wide range of great reporters on that topic. It was happening in Myanmar and stuff like that. And you know, look, Trump is Trump. I honestly can't believe I'm saying this, but I got him. He said it out loud what he was going to do. It wasn't like it was hidden. He didn't say, I'm a nice guy, and then turn around and do the Muslim ban. He said, I'm going to ban Muslims. I'm going to do this. You know, he just said it over and over again, and I kind of took him at his word. So when my issue was them, who went on and on to me about what good people they were and how they wanted to protect democracy, and they really are different. They're change makers. I've had it with them. They're not change makers. They're change keepers, right? If they needed to suck up to this son of a bitch, they were going to do it. And even if they thought he was a buffoon, which they called him that over and over to me, I was like, I don't have any time for you if you're going to tell me, oh, don't worry, Kara, I know he's a buffoon. And then in public, say nothing. I just don't have any time for you. Either just don't tell me you think he's a buffoon privately so that I like you better. I like you less because you do that kind of thing. And so that really just irritated me, is that they, first of all, that they didn't tell anybody they were doing it. And I had to. Actually, that was a good scoop of mine. Nobody knew. Nobody in the tech press knew they were doing that. That would seem to be something they might want to put a press release out on, but they didn't because they were embarrassed by their behavior. I called them sheeple. I was like, you know, sheep people. Like, are you? All they cared about was getting that money back, that repatriation of those funds, the tax break they liked. No regulations to speak of. Someone they could get contracts from, and that they didn't care about any of the other repercussions of the Trump administration. Maybe a little bit around the edges when he actually did call for the Muslim ban, but to a person, including Elon, he's not going to do the Muslim ban, Kara. He won't. It's just talk. I was like, I don't think it's talk. I think he means it. He said it like 712 times on the campaign trail. Like, I kind of feel like he means it. Like, you know, but you know, they knew better. They knew better.
Is it the Trump years and that turmoil that fractured your relationships with some of these executives?
Some of them. Not all of them, because I think, you know, I don't know if it was fractured. I had already gone that direction and was known as being tough. I think after a series of interviews, like that really tough one. Well, that was late. Well, the one where Mark Sweat.
That's the one I was rewatching to prepare for this conversation. Let me actually just go ahead and play a little bit of that. It's been almost 15 years. So let me refresh people's memories with this clip of Kara. We all are. But this is a very nervous, very sweaty Zuckerberg in 2010.
Yes, he was.
Do you feel like it's a backlash, or that you feel like you're violating people's privacy?
Do you feel like you're adequately portrayed as a, because I want to wonder about the person who actually created this thing.
Yeah, I mean, I a lot of stuff happened along the way. I think, there were real learning points and turning points along the way in terms of building things. You know, it really went from this position very early on where we were just in this college dorm room to we moved out to California. It was a few friends and me. And, it just kind of had this project feel for a while. And there was this real turning point when companies started trying to buy the company for a huge amount of money. And, you know, I had to kind of get my friends together and we had to decide what was it that we really cared about and what was it that we wanted to do. We decided not to take those offers. And,
right.
You know, to me, a lot of that decision was that what we wanted to do and what we wanted to spend, you know, a big part of our lives doing was just continuing to push and kind of build products that help people share information,
right.
Build products that help people stay connected. And that's really what we're spending our time doing. And, you know, I think you know, there's just been a lot of space between that early stuff and where we are now. If I knew what I knew now then I hope I wouldn't have made those mistakes. But I can't go back and change the past. I can only do what we think is the right thing going forward.
So before we move off this privacy thing, and I thought that was a fascinating answer.
Okay, you want to take off the hoodie?
No, I never take off the
hoodie. I know you don't. What's with that? There's a group of women in the audience that wish you would.
No.
So certainly that is one of those moments, Kara, where everybody looks around and says, Kara is taking no prisoners.
That wasn't me. Let me just say, he sweat. That was his panic attack or whatever it was. He said he was sick. I thought I was very sweet to him, trying to get him to calm down because I was worried about that he'd faint. Someone had told me he had a fainting problem. Might have been one of his relatives. And I just was worried about his health at that moment. I really was. I mean, I take off your jacket. He wasn't going to take off his friggin' jacket. And I was like, you need to take off your jacket. And, you know, he was embarrassed. I thought Walt and I were rather nice to him during that exchange. And I tried to make a joke. I tried to calm it down. I thought that was a rather nice version of me. I don't think he even wrote me a note saying thank you and Walt and I. And you know, very few people thought that was our fault. That he just got nervous because he had been asked those questions dozens of times. It wasn't like we were breaking hard ground there with the privacy questions that Walt was asking him. He had been asked that a dozen times in the weeks before that. So it just was a bad day for Mark Zuckerberg.
I take your point that by the Trump era, though, these interviews have become folklore.
The problem came when the third interview, which was when I went to Facebook headquarters. I always like to interview people at their headquarters because they feel safe. I'm like, sure, you're safe. Sure, whatever. And so we had this interview. And in the middle of it, I was arguing with him about Alex Jones because I had it with fucking Alex Jones. I was like, he's on your platform. He's breaking every rule you made. I looked at your rules. He broke them 78 times at this point or whatever it was. Are you going to do anything about it? It was sort of like, hey, mayor, why are you letting this guy take a shit in the public park every day? Like, didn't you say no shits in the public park? I would like to know what you're doing. I'm a citizen, a concerned citizen. And so he wanted to shift it to Holocaust deniers, which I was like, oh, no, 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 please don't go there. I feel like I'm much more educated on this topic than you are, for one, because I studied it in college. There's no winning when you start to defend Holocaust deniers, right? I was like, oh, don't, you're just not equipped to do this. And, it's not that he's not smart. It's just, it's not an easy argument to make well if you're this absolutely good at it. And so he then wandered down to this highway where he just started not making any sense, right? About and saying they didn't mean to lie and everything else. And it was so offensive. One of the things I think I did really well in that interview was say nothing. If you listen to that interview, I am very like, well, that's an interesting take. I'm going to just let it go. And he just, you know, I wanted people to understand that he was not equipped to deal with this problem, right? And not that he's not a nice man. He is a nice man, personally, very nice and very earnest, but he wasn't equipped and he had unlimited power.
Much more with Kara Swisher in just a minute.
Thank you. I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
And we're back here on Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. I'm Brian Stelter, speaking with a longtime friend of mine, Kara Swisher. Her new memoir is titled Burn Book. Well, hearing you talk about all this, Kara, I mentioned that Burn Book's subtitle is a tech love story. But if this is a love story, it seems like a relationship that went off the rails.
Not all of it. I have a whole chapter of people I like. I like Steve Jobs. There's no way you could walk. I'm sure I'll get like whacked for saying I didn't say he was a nice guy. I never did. I said he was a really prescient guy. And I thought he really cared about things I cared about, like privacy and things like that. And I thought he was really innovative and interesting thinker. And someone who could be challenged, even though you don't think you could, you could challenge him. I mean, compared to today, he's like a walk in the friggin' park.
But what about CEOs who are alive? Who else?
I think Brian Chesky's. I have a lot of admiration for him. I think he's developed. Evan Spiegel at Snapchat, someone I really didn't get along with at the beginning. Mark Cuban and I used to be like, fuck you, no, fuck you, no, fuck you. And we actually have developed a really long-term, really interesting relationship.
But you mentioned Brian Chesky, so he's the CEO of Airbnb. So what Airbnb. Is it about him?
Yeah. He's thoughtful. He acts like an adult. He doesn't even act his age because he's quite young when I met him. But he had, I don't know why he was a good guy, good parents. I'm not sure. I don't know. You know, good guy, just a really thoughtful guy. And he made a lot of mistakes. And I wrote about every one of them. You know, as you remember early on, they had all kinds of issues. Remember, there was that orgy.
I do not remember the orgy.
It was an orgy that wrecked the apartment.
Owners of this Sage Hill home watch as hazmat crews remove furnishings and belongings damaged by what police call a drug-induced orgy.
I'm just so glad our neighbors don't think we're the criminals anymore.
The home was rented via Airbnb to a man for the weekend last month.
Any one day that could happen to anybody. He made a lot of mistakes and he owned up to them. At least he tried, you know, like he didn't pretend they didn't exist. He didn't get all like, oh, how dare you attack me? Never. No, he's not like that.
Brands like Airbnb and Uber and Instagram, they're all a part of our lives now. But are those still emerging? Are we seeing new versions of that?
Yes, we will. I don't know what they will be. You know, I think with AGI, artificial general intelligence, you're going to see all kinds of new things that are going to be your assistant, or it's going to change how you write things, or we don't know. Like, can you imagine if you were handed the iPhone, as remember you were in 2007, that's when I got it for one of the first ones. You didn't know what that was going to be. It certainly wasn't. It's like looking at a television and having two programs. Could you have anticipated like True Detective with Jodie Foster this many years later? No, you wouldn't have, or streaming or whatever. And I think where it's going is not clear. You can sort of begin to see the edges of it, like what it's going to do. You know,
we were at a dinner recently and you were floored by Apple Vision Pro. You were selling everybody on why it was so significant. So that's an example of one where there's still really is real innovation coming out of the tech industry.
We'll see. Yeah. Oh, yeah. AGI is really interesting. There is so much that could be done here. I just don't know who's going to do it and how, right? That's the one thing. It also has huge potential for danger. Like, that's very easy to see. The danger stuff is glare, bright red and blinking at you. But there's also potential for great things. That's also, there's a lot of green lights everywhere. And that'll matter on how much our government and our democratic process is part of the development of it, puts guardrails in place.
Stay with us. More with Kara in a minute.
The 2024 election means this year is going to be chock full of drama and nail-biting suspense. You deserve a politics and news podcast with expert analysis. No spin, no BS. Just trusted journalists talking about what you need to know. I'm David Plotz, and each week on Slate's Political Gabfest, I sit down with the New York Times' Emily Bazelon and CBS News' John Dickerson to do just that. Join us as we unpack the latest in politics, news, and the courts. Listen to the Political Gabfest every Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
we're back here on Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. I'm Brian Stelter, speaking with Kara Swisher. Her new book is titled Burn Book. Here's a headline from CNBC this week. Magnificent Seven profits now exceed almost every country in the world. This combines, you know, Apple, Amazon, Alphabet, Meta, Microsoft, Nvidia, and Tesla. The idea that these are nation states, and they are bigger than most actual states. Isn't it that must terrify you, at least on one level?
It does. It doesn't. You know, I think one of the key moments in the book, I have to say, is when I got into a bickering with the Google founders. And I had written a pretty tough story in Recode where I said they absolutely cannot have 97% of search. They were trying to buy Yahoo, if you recall, or at least control it. I think that was some deal. I don't remember. There were several different ways they were trying to get control of Yahoo. And if they did, they would have owned the whole. They already owned a lot of the enchilada. They wanted the rest of it. And I wrote a really tough piece, and I used Dr. Seuss rhymes as the way I wrote it. And I said, they would not, could not own it all, or something like that. I was being clever, too clever by a half. And I was very clear. I was like, the government cannot allow this. This needs to be stopped by anyone listening. And I put in a line, it was a throwaway line. And I said, you know, the difference here, at least Microsoft knew they were thugs. And one of them called me. They were like, you know us. You're our friend. I'm like, first of all, I'm not your friend. I'm not. I don't. You need to get friends because I'm not one of them. And I knew them. That's very different. I'm covering them. And of course, there's some level of charm and seduction that goes into journalism, right? There's some, and I don't mean sexual, just like you have to get people to talk to you. They're like, you know us, Kara. You know we're not bad people. It was this whole thing. Like, they were hurt by me calling them thugs. Like, I'm like, you know, grow a set, you guys, because you're going to hear a lot of worse things. Mm-hmm. And they go, we're nice people. And I said, you know what? Here's the problem that I have with you people is that I'm not talking about you. I'm talking about the next version of this. Who owns this? I don't know what rough beast is slouching towards Bethlehem waiting to be born, but it's coming. That person is coming. Every single tool that's been used for good has been used for very bad. Every radio with Hitler, you know, it was used by FDR, but it was used by Hitler, right? Everything, every single technology, media technology has been abused. And I was like, I don't think you're evil. I think someone is evil and they're coming. They're coming and they're here. And they didn't get that. I just was sort of like, do you not read history? Do you not see how it's happened before? And don't you see that if you have the concentration in unaccountable hands among the world's richest people, we might have a problem. And someone's going to turn bad. Someone's going to use it for bad. And they always do. So
I, for some reason, totally coincidentally, find myself thinking about Elon Musk now.
I think he's quite dangerous.
You talk about your relationship with Musk, you describe it as someone always willing to engage on a semi-human basis.
Well, he'd answer your question and not have a talking point. It was a pleasure.
So what was he like then versus now? What's changed about him?
He was funny. You know, he was always juvenile. He was funny. He was interesting. He was reflective. You know what I mean? He's so smart and, you know, he has an interesting mind. He's not the genius everyone thinks he is, but he certainly is hugely smart. A lot of it's performative, you know, a lot of like, I'm a genius, therefore I'm a genius kind of thing. There's a lot of people I know that are smarter than him, but he's very smart, no question, and good at business.
And you do say he was the first person to alert you. He alerted 100%. You to the implications of advanced machine learning.
Yes, yeah. That's because he had a great interest in sci-fi fiction and stuff like that. You know, he a lot of sci-fi does track on things that are coming. And he was, you know, one thing I liked about him, he was well-read. He was, a lot of these people aren't well-read. He was very well-read, and especially in sci-fi and pop culture and gaming. You know, I found that interesting. Like he had a life beyond his job, which I thought was interesting. The other thing was he was working on what I considered real problems, like climate with cars, space, because our world is under great existential threat. We do have to be, I hate to repeat him, but a multi-planet civilization. We do need to think about that if we want to keep going. We can just be destroyed. That's our other our choice. But it's not the stupidest thing in the world to say at all. It's actually quite prescient. And the other stuff, even if it was kind of silly, the Hyperloop was interesting. We should have tunnels under cities. He's right. Like, not just him. Lots of people had thought this. By the way, he often says he thought of at first when he didn't. But that's okay. Whatever. Thomas Edison did the same thing. Whatever. Although I think probably Thomas Edison was a more important inventor in many ways. Because Elon buys things and then brings them forward, other people's inventions.
In Twitter or X being the most recent
whatever,
example.
Tesla, you know, all of it. And so I do think he has a genuine interest in space, though. I think he's quite innovative. He's been very innovative there. And so that was cool. And everybody else in Silicon Valley at the time was doing like a dating service, right? Or a dry cleaning service. And you'd be sitting there and I'd get like, oh, I get it. I'm doing a new dry cleaning service. And I'm like, oh, kill me now. Like, it's going to be helped digital. It's a digital. I was like, clothes are dirty. You're just making it deliveries, right? It just was like exhausting after a while. And it was such a scam, essentially. And he was talking about real things. And so it was very appealing. There were always the little, you know, the things at the factories, the racial issues. But again, a lot of Silicon Valley's had these sexist, racist issues, right? All of them did. We did not cover. We covered the sexist stuff pretty well at Recode. The racial stuff, we did not, I would say. I think that was a real fail on my part. But we covered a lot of this stuff. And every now and then he'd pop off with a hugely juvenile thing for a man his age, like boob jokes, penis jokes, et cetera, et cetera. And you'd be like, oh, whatever. Like, I don't care if you want to talk. You seem to get the ladies, so I don't know what to tell you. Like, whatever. And so it was really interesting. One of the first signs of it was when he did that pedo thing with a guy, throwing that word around. That was weird. I was like, huh. That's strange. And
right, accusing someone of being a pedophile.
A British diver who played a key role in the rescue effort of that Thai soccer team trapped in a dark cave for weeks is back in the headlines. He's considering legal action against Elon Musk over comments the billionaire made on Twitter.
I was like, wow, that's odd. Why did you do that?
And like, now I feel like we have him in our heads every day. We're hearing his inside jokes, his weird juvenile behavior every single day.
Yes, just maybe he was like this, but he wasn't. He really was. Everyone's like mad at me because you used to like him. I'm like, I did. What do you want me to say? I'm not denying it. I'm not going to also be shamed for it. And then we were doing an interview. I mean, maybe it was around, it was during COVID, I guess, where he got freaked out about, because I was asking about his ridiculous COVID pronouncements. There would be zero deaths. Like, I was like, you're not a doctor, right? You're just making shit up. I read all the studies. I read them all. I know better. And I was like, I'm going to say you don't, like, because I certainly don't know where it's going. And I think the more responsible thing for a leader to do is say, we don't know. Let's see. Let's try to be extra special safe, right? Without the knowledge. And he threatened to leave the interview. He had never done that. It was weird. But those started to pile up. Right. That idea of I am the only person, that I am Ready Player One, that started to really emerge. And then it just got egomaniacal in a way that was very strange. And then he became, you know, he had talked about the idea that in one of our interviews that this was all an illusion. Everything was an illusion.
It's all a simulation. Is that the idea?
Right. That was fascinating. I was fascinated with that. And he was the first person to really publicly articulate, which was a little trend in Silicon Valley on that topic. And I thought, oh, he thinks we're in a simulation and he's the main player. Like that's where I got. I was like, oh, he thinks he's the main character in this, in the world.
The main character.
He does. That's what it is. And everyone else doesn't matter. So if he insults women or gays or who, it doesn't matter because they're fungible characters. They can be moved along. They don't matter. And so once you put that in your head, you're like, oh, I get it. I see. He's playing a video game in his head.
Hearing this about Elon, I feel like Elon's the best thing that's ever happened to Mark Zuckerberg, because Zuckerberg's image was so tarnished. There were so many concerns about Meta. And now Zuckerberg's like the cool guy who's out kayaking or whatever in Hawaii.
Yeah. Well, he's still got problems. I thought that scene at Congress last week was, I was looking in his eyes and I thought, is it sinking in yet?
Oh, you're talking about the parents of dead children who stood up and have accused social media. Yeah.
And they have a right to do so. And I thought, please, for the love of God, say you're sorry for what you did. And what did he say? I'm sorry for what happened to you. Oh, I was like, damn, man. You had your moment to do something and you didn't do it, did you? You couldn't do it. You couldn't admit any kind of accountability on something like this. You didn't have to do that much. You could have said, whatever I have done, to make this happen. I am so sorry. Any of those things he could have done, but he didn't.
Well, in the book, you helped reframe that old early Facebook motto. The motto was move fast and break things.
Break.
How do you deconstruct that now?
They're still breaking things. He still can't see it. You know what I mean? I wish he could. The reason I'm trying to be slightly nice to Mark here is because I see, look, Bill Gates, remember when he was Darth Vader? I think Bill Gates had changed the narrative about around himself with the philanthropy. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's performative. I think he's really making changes, right? He really is. And now he's talking about climate change. Mark has that potential in him. Let me tell you, he's a much better person than Bill Gates ever was. And I think Bill Gates has moved. I just feel like he has the potential to... I'm so glad he didn't do that stupid fight with Elon. That was a good, I was like, huh.
Oh, the cage match. Well, I think Zuckerberg's won the cage match. I mean, I think through his actions, through the market cap of his company.
Yeah, exactly. But he didn't do it. I was thinking, please don't do this. And you like your sport. I get it. I get you found something you like, but don't fall into this circus with this loudmouth egomaniac.
And he did. He avoided it.
And he didn't. Avoided it. I was like, well, that's a low bar, isn't it, Brian? people.
Here's the other line in Burn Book that really stuck with me. And I wrote it down. I highlighted it. You said the information that is now digitized is actually us, right? And mm-hmm. if you think about it, you know, clearly ChatGPT, all of these new products, they're scraping us and delivering us back to people. But it was so helpful to think about it in that way. It was so helpful to illustrate that. What do you want people to do with that, you know, image that all this information that's us?
It's important.
Just digital.
Thank you for pulling that out. Brian, all I can tell you is Soylent Green is people. Please see the chart. I'm not talking about that stupid drink, those techies. They're all on Ozempic now, so they're past Soylent, which was a drink they drank because food was too hard to eat.
Yes, they were too busy.
How fucking ridiculous that was. It tasted like shit, too. Soylent Green is people. It's a movie. There you go. Charlton Heston, terrible person, great movies. I loved all his crazy fucking... end time movies. He had a lot of real dark movies, and this one was one of the darkest. And it's about, I'm not going to give away the plot here, but Soylent Green is people. It's a food that we have to eat because of our shitty world, because of climate change, et cetera, et cetera. And it turns out it's people. It's made of people because that's a good protein. And we are Soylent Green, and we are letting them feed it back to ourselves. And that's really astonishing. And it's ours. And we should stop doing that. We should stop letting them do that, because they'll do it because they're capitalists and they'll do it because they like power. It's up to us now to do something about it. You know, it's not unlike what Jon Stewart said the other day on his first week back. I love Jon Stewart. And he's like, let's stop complaining about them. It's about us every single fucking day. And that's, I really believe that. I think we have to push our public officials. I think we should say no to things. I think we should demand change. And you know, in a democracy, that tends to work out over time, not perfectly, but ultimately, that's our internet. We built it. That was ours. And you and I don't like what you've done with the place. So we want you to change things. So.
And we actually have a voice in that. You don't surrender to the.
Did we surrender to all, you know, ultimately the Rockefellers? We got them eventually. You know, the Rockefellers or the Carnegies or the train barons. No, like eventually, then did they change our society in ways that were not so good a lot of the time? Yes. But ultimately, I'll quote another one of my favorite pieces of creativity, which is Angels in America, the last part, the two parts. The world only spins forward. We can spin it forward. Absolutely. And this is the time to do it right now, because right now the stakes are huge with AGI and everything else.
I love the spinning. Kara, thank you for the spin.
All right. No problem.
And once again, Kara's new book is titled Burn Book, A Tech Love Story, and it's on sale February 27th. This episode of Inside the Hive was produced by Michael May. Stephen Valentino is our executive producer. Chris Bannon is Condé Nast's head of global audio. We had engineering assistance today from Gabe Kuroga and mixing by Bob Mallory. And I'm Brian Stelter. You can find me on Twitter and Threads at Brian Stelter, or feel free to reach out to me directly. Send me an email. I'm at bstelter@gmail.com. I love hearing from you about the show, and I especially love hearing your guest ideas for future episodes. We'll be back in your podcast feed next week.
Three, two, one. Political Breakdown is a daily politics podcast from KQED in San Francisco that goes deep into the issues you care about. I'm Scott Schaefer.
And I'm Marisa Lagos. Look, 2024 is gonna get weird.
Who decides when there's been an insurrection or not?
We're still in the innovation phase of AI.
And that is where you see that they're not actually being equitable and trying to build a utopia where we can all use drugs happily together.
But whatever happens this election year, the KQED Politics team is in this with you. Political Breakdown. Find it wherever you listen to podcasts.